A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Hopefully you had a great weekend. This was like the sweet spot in Central Virginia. It was warm enough to be outside without a coat, maybe a hoodie if you needed it in the wind, dry enough that I could actually go down to my shooting spot here on the farm. And I actually got a chance to do a little bit of shooting because it's still early enough in the year that I don't have to spend several hours on a lawnmower. So, yeah, it was a great weekend for me. Hopefully it was a good weekend for you as well. Do have a lot of stuff to talk about. Once again, the Supreme Court taking no action on Snope versus Brown. That is the case taking on Maryland's ban on so-called assault weapons. No action on Ocean State Tactical versus Narona. That is the challenge to Rhode Island's ban on quote-unquote high-capacity magazines. So, presumably, the court will relist these cases for conference this Thursday, and we'll have to wait and see if they are a part of next Monday's orders list. It is possible that we could get a random order from the court at some point this week dealing with these cases. But again, radio silence from the court, right? So they did not grant cert. They did not deny cert. We didn't see a dissent from the denial. I mean, we don't know what's going on. And, you know, we talked last week with Adam Crowd from the Second Amendment Foundation, who says, you know, historically, the longer these cases are held, the less likely it is that cert is granted, which is kind of surprising to me. I figured that it was the opposite, that the longer a case stuck around, the more likely it was that it would be eventually granted cert. I know with Heller, I think that was relisted five times. So I think maybe a total of six lists. Maybe it was a total of five lists before it was granted cert. But this is just weird. And frankly, Snope has been weird, I won't say from the beginning, but for quite a while. I mean, you remember, this is the case where a three-judge panel on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals back in December of 2022 heard oral arguments. Then they waited more than a year, apparently because there was going to be a good opinion for, in terms of, you know, where you and I would stand. And the dissenting judge on that three-judge panel basically never turned in their dissent for publication. And so the majority, basically acting on custom and you know, past precedent, held on to their decision, didn't release it. And then the Fourth Circuit decided, you know what, you don't need to, because we're going to go ahead and take this case en banc, even though you haven't ruled yet. So all of that work, it's for nothing. We're going to go ahead and hold oral arguments again. This time, the entire Fourth Circuit is going to weigh in. And they did. And they upheld Maryland's gun ban. So even before this case got to the Supreme Court, there were some, let's say, irregularities. Things that do not normally happen as a case is proceeding up the chain of, you know, up the ladder, basically, in the courts of appeals. And the oddities continue now with the Supreme Court once again keeping their cards close to the vest and keeping mum about the future of Snope. So we won't be talking about the Snope case today, other than what I just mentioned. Instead, we're going to be talking about what's going on out in Colorado, where among the bad bills that are still alive, right, you've got that sweeping semi-auto ban. Basically, every gas-operated semi-automatic firearm would be declared prohibited unless, if you really wanted to own one of these weapons of war that don't belong in American streets, as the gun control advocates like to say, you could take an additional training course. You could submit your fingerprints to the state of Colorado. You could basically identify yourself as the owner of one of these firearms, and then you could purchase one. It's weird. There's also the bill that would bar 18, 19, and 20-year-olds from purchasing, I believe, possessing ammunition as well. That's making progress. Meanwhile, pro-gun bills, like a bill to actually scrap Colorado's shall issue concealed carry law and replace it with a permitless carry law. I mean, obviously, that bill went nowhere. But today's guest actually was watching this hearing and heard, I won't say it's an unusual argument because we've heard it before, but heard one of the more despicable arguments used to attack our right to keep and bear arms, citing the racist gun laws in our nation's history. And Kellen Lanier was so bothered by this that he sat down and he wrote up an article. Now, Kellen is not formally affiliated with any Second Amendment group. He's a gun owner and a Second Amendment advocate all on his own. But he had his column published at WeTheSecondColorado.com, which is where I ran across it. Colorado lawmaker. This is the headline. Colorado lawmaker reveals allegiance to the South's historically racist gun laws as basis to deny rights, which is inaccurate. Reading of what happened. So I reached out to Kellen, see if he could come on the program. He had the chance to talk last Thursday. Great conversation. Looking forward to having him back again very soon. I will let you know that right off the bat. But take a listen to Kellen Lanier, Second Amendment advocate in Colorado, talking about this year's session and the deplorable arguments deployed by the anti-gun left there in Colorado. Kellen, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Yeah, good to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, well, I ran across your piece at WeTheSecondColorado.com, and this is fascinating. So this is about a week or so old now, posted on February 28th, talking about Representative Javier Mabry, who's a state lawmaker. And I was fascinated because we've been talking so much about the bad gun bills in Colorado this year, the semi-auto ban, the bill to raise the age to purchase ammunition. I didn't realize that there were any good bills that have been introduced. They haven't gone very far, but they've at least been introduced, right? And a constitutional carry bill actually got a hearing this year. Is that right?
Yeah, it did. It did.
It didn't advance, but what did Representative Mabry say during this hearing that made you sit up and say, all right, we need a rebuttal here?
Mm-hmm. You know, with this bill, I think everybody kind of knew it was doomed from the start, but it was very interesting to see the usual suspects, the usual paid suspects come up and give their testimony, and do all of the circus is what I call it. And hearing the representatives in this case, since it was in the House, hearing their justifications for yes or no, the majority of them were no, because they stacked the deck that way. You expect to hear the usual, weapons of war, no civilized society, nobody needs an assault weapon, even though this was constitutional carry. You expect to hear those things, but he instead decided to go after Bruin, right? And say, well, you know, the Bruin decision is something that, you know, we now kind of have to respect. I think that was kind of the subtext. And in doing so, he cited laws to say, well, look, this is, you know, the laws that we write in this building regarding gun, you know, confiscation. Maybe that's a little too far, but, you know, just their version of gun laws,
right,
are completely satisfied Bruin because of all of these laws from the past, like Bruin says. The unfortunate part for him is that he, or maybe his aides, I don't know who actually went and did this very quick Google search, picked all of the racist laws from Georgia to make this point of, hey, these are past laws. Bruin says pick past laws. Therefore, it satisfies Bruin because it's in line with these. Didn't research or anything like that. So
you did, and you called him out on it. I want to quote from your piece just a little bit here. You said, In his closing statements to justify his no vote on this bill, he said by 1800, four states had enacted gun carry restrictions. And then, as you say, he briefly cited this 1837 Georgia statute banning the carry of various types of Bowie knives and pistols. Beyond the racist implications of citing an 1830s weapons law in Georgia, you also say that he neglected to mention that that law was overturned in Nunn versus Georgia in 1846 for being unconstitutional. I apparently didn't do much more than the cursory research, right? Another hearer's aid. But, you say that this is a broader point here, right? You say that Mabry, quote, revealed the typically carefully tucked away, utter contempt for Black Americans and Black Coloradans that many progressives of his pedigree hold. The single focus on banning guns at all costs, blindly progressive legislator to the reality of the world, thrusting them into the same bucket of those with terminal white privilege that they often decry. And you say that the good news is that now the quiet part's out loud, right? And we can start to see these progressives for what they really are, a more salient threat to freedom than the raging overt racist that they point to as the enemy. Now we can confidently act and vote accordingly. And I think that is... I got to say, Kellen, I think that that is really, I mean, you hit the tin ring there, because I'm sure that Representative Mabry would say, how dare you call me racist? How dare you lump me in with people who would, deprive those of color of any of their rights? And yet, when you look at how these gun control laws are applied, listen, I think facially what they're trying to do is unconstitutional. But, legally, we talk about these facial challenges where they're unconstitutional in every circumstance. And then as applied challenges to laws where, OK, maybe they're legal in some circumstances, but as applied to this particular person, this law violates their rights. Mm-hmm. Again, I think both facially and as applied to people of color, these gun control laws are unconstitutional and they do have a disproportionate impact on people of color. We just talked a couple of weeks ago with the director of a nonprofit group called Rise Against Hate, who had done some research into the concealed carry permitting process in New Jersey. And what they found is that Black applicants were more than 10 times as likely to be denied a carry permit than a white applicant. You can read the public defender's brief in Bruin and the disproportionate impact of the May issue laws in New York, the stop and frisk laws in New York, right? So for you to call out the Democrats for this, I have to say I really applaud you, because this is something that the left doesn't really want to talk about. And frankly, there may be some folks on the right who don't want to talk about it either. Maybe it reminds them of DEI and they don't want to go there. But this is something that I think as Second Amendment advocates, we absolutely have to talk about, because this is a right of we the people. And that's a broad, all-encompassing term.
It is. It is. When I first wrote this, that was my thought. I'm like, wow, I am writing this to a group of gun people. and just the stereotype. And what made me send this out and say, hey, will someone publish this? Because I didn't know if anybody would even pick this up. It was almost just a Facebook post. I'm just like, wait, no, gun rights are human rights. And we need to get to that point. And even when you look at these testimonies, when you go there, you have it's literally the civil rights movement all over again. You have on one side, you have a group of white women, all in red shirts and crying. And then you have a diverse group of just regular people that just got off of work that are just trying to make a difference, far outnumbering them. And I'm like, no, we need to hear this. Those people in red shirts, ironically enough, they need to hear it too. Because it's, we have to get to a point where we start asking this question of when do gun rights, become a social imperative? This is more than just, I like guns and so I want to collect them and how dare you? There is a real social aspect to this. And when you look at even the bill, the people that put forth this bill in the fiscal note acknowledge that there will be a disparate impact. You know, and this was put out after my article. You know, so it gives it even more credence that, like, no, this isn't just an angry black man. You know, this is something that is real that they have to face too.
And what's amazing, I mean, you say they acknowledge that there's going to be a disparate impact. So on some level, at least, they're willing to face that and they're okay with it, right? I mean, what other conclusion can you draw? If they say, okay, yes, there is going to be a disproportionate impact on minorities, but we're going to move ahead with this. They're not amending the bill, right? They're not even calling for some commission to make sure that the law is applied, you know, equitably across the board. No, they're just full speed ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a way to apply this law equitably. You know, when you think about it, it's upping the penalty. You know, Mabry always says, you know, we don't want to create new crimes. You know, I think right. There should be an asterisk that just floats above his head every single time that happens, because, you know, he's now in a position to create a new crime. And, you know, like the hidden heritage he's trying to hide, it's affecting black people disproportionately. I believe the numbers for prior offenses was like white 102, black 86. And then when you look at the and these were prior offenses. So these are things that are already on the books. So 100 to 286, that's like what, 20, a difference of 20 something, you know, but when you look at the population difference, there's a huge problem.
Yeah.
You know, because in Colorado, black people are what, 6% of the population. So it's like, why is that so high? And going back to what you were saying about the other law, was that New Jersey?
Yeah. New Jersey.
Yeah. These are all the precursors for disparate effect, and they're just going to push this through to save 8 lives. What about all of those other lives ruined in different ways?
Absolutely. You know, and it's funny too. I mean, you talk about Representative Mabry not was saying that he doesn't want to create any new crimes. I noticed this in the last session in Colorado, where the Democrats, you know, they had so many gun control bills. And you would look at, like, okay, so what's the punishment or what's the penalty for violating this law? And because they didn't, you know, they ran headlong into their desire for gun control and also their desire for criminal justice reform. And so, you know, like violation of last year's semi-auto ban, originally no jail time, but it was like a $250,000 fine, right? So we're not going to put you in jail, but we're going to bankrupt you. We'll ruin your life that way. And that's better, right? Rather than just acknowledge that, hey, you know what? Maybe we could just protect people's civil rights. Maybe we don't have to try to criminalize them, punish them financially, or incarcerate them. That, I guess, is the bridge too far, right?
Yeah, it's a bridge too far. And if you think about it, all politics has a element of cognitive dissonance. And I just think that they are a little bit more masterful in their application and manipulation of cognitive dissonance, where they can say these things. They can say, hey, to the public, we are all for, you know, giving people a second chance, seeing the humanity in people. And then when it comes to things that they don't like, it's utter inhumanity. You know, it is. You know, these people are dangerous. I recently had a conversation with another representative where it was, you know, just conflating gun people, meaning law-abiding gun owners, with mass shooters, and saying, well, if we arm all people, then everybody will die. And just really, you know, standing on that. And it was perplexing, because I'm like, I'm a gun person, so am I now just a threat just because, you know, just by mere existence of a gun in my room, I'm a threat?
Yeah, and that's the answer for a lot of these folks is yeah. I mean, I remember an exchange, Poe Murray, who's a gun control activist with the Newtown, I think it's the Newtown Action League or something like that. At one point a couple of years ago, I had tweeted out That if you owned an AR-15, that you were basically endorsing mass murder. And my friend Ryan Petty, who lost his daughter at Parkland, and who is a gun owner himself, said, okay, so are you saying that I want to see kids murdered? And her response was yes. You know, to tell the father of a child who was murdered that he's okay with that because he's not calling for a gun ban. I mean, that, it's a warped mindset. I don't get it, but we see it on display from the gun control advocates all the time.
Yeah, it's programming. That's what it is. You know, it, and like I said, it happens on both sides. And, you know, it's, you know, I think that's the real danger. And that's the real arms race we need to be concerned with, rather than does someone have a gun to protect themselves? It's, you know, is the gang that you're a part of, the political gang that you're a part of, how effectively are they manipulating people into hate? Because we know from the civil rights movement and everything that led up to that, it was fueled by hate. And what that does to a human being, especially in groups, is it lowers your IQ. You know, you go from being able to think about consequences to not even think about consequences because, you know, someone that you affiliate, you know, with told you that these people are dangerous. So you're just going to believe it.
You know, yeah.
Does it sound familiar? You know, if you take away the descriptors and you say, these people are dangerous, stay away from them. They'll kill you. They'll come out of a bush and murder everybody. You know, we had propaganda in the early 1900s to 1800s, but it was blackface. Now they're trying to change it a little bit, but it's still the same thing. And that perplexes me when they come out and use these tactics and people just eat it up. You know, how do you get so many people to fly out from wherever, you know, and sit here and parade around their dead sisters and whatever pants? You know, there's something really wicked about that, you know, but they still do it. And yeah,
they do. And that is, you know, unfortunately what we're up against. And, you know, I mean, again, it gets back to something that you said earlier about the right to keep and bear arms is a human right. And this is a civil rights fight that we are in. Right. I mean, I have come to the conclusion after 20 years of covering the Second Amendment on a daily basis that while the Second Amendment is a right of we the people, historically, its benefits have been, I think, best exercised by the underdog in society, right? Yeah. Those who, again, are targeted by the majority. And, you know, you can look at Ida Wells' comment about the Winchester repeating rifle deserves a place of honor in every black home. You know, what was the context in which he said that? Well, it was right after you had this, you know, race riot and lynching in Memphis. And where she lived at the time, right? And she ultimately had to move out of Memphis because it wasn't safe for her. Judge Stephen McGlynn in Illinois, when he struck down the gun and magazine ban that was part of the Protect Illinois Communities Act, his opinion talks extensively about the riot in East St. Louis, and I believe it was 1917. And, you know, he documented instances of Black Americans who defended their families, who defended their neighbors with firearms. Professor Nicholas Johnson at Fordham University has a fantastic book called Negroes and the Gun, the Black Tradition of Arms in America. And it is, you know, it's eye opening. And one of the things that I really took away, I grew up in Oklahoma, and he's got a chapter in there about the Tulsa Race Massacre. And I never learned about that in school, by the way, in Oklahoma. It just wasn't brought up. We learned about the land run, but not that. But one of the things that he wrote about in that book was after the destruction of the Black community in Tulsa. There was he was a child at the time, but he would go on to become a pretty well-known Black historian. And he talked about the change in attitude among the Black residents in Tulsa, that they, you know, they were not afraid because they had stood up to these aggressors. They had defended themselves. And that really struck me that, you know, you would think afterwards that you would have a community living in fear because of what had happened. But according to this individual who lived there in Tulsa, who grew up there at the time, there was also this sense of, and pardon my, I'll keep it family friendly. If you F with us, you will find out, right? And you know, that too is a part of our right to keep and bear arms. We are talking often about individual self-defense, the ability to protect yourself from an intruder, a home invader, somebody on the street. But community self-defense, collective self-defense, is an inherent part of this individual right. And as you say, you talk about, you know, what hate does to a community. I think the opposite of that, the counter effect of that, again, is the ability for communities to protect and defend themselves. So, Kellen, again, man, I like I said, I really appreciate you coming on the program. I would encourage folks to read your article. Can we have you back? Because I just really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, you can always have me back. That's, you know, and I'll be fighting this as long as it takes. You know, I spoke to a civil rights, someone in the civil rights movement, I feel like this is important to say, you know, because in getting into this, I wanted to know that I was on the right side of history, and who better to ask than history? So there was, I did kind of like a little pilgrimage trip to Alabama and visited Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma, all of these different places. And along the way, I spoke to one of the individuals now who was one of the, what they called the child foot soldiers, you know, when they all came out, ditched school to march, and got hosed down, that whole thing. And I asked, I said, what do you think about now? You know, and her response was very chilling. I have it recorded somewhere. And, you know, she was talking about the nonviolence in all of that. And the takeaway was, I don't think that nonviolence and intentionally disarming ourselves is the right move this time. You know, she was saying, hey, this, when we did it, we did not have the means. So we had to. Things are different now. And there is fear. And there is fear from both sides. You know, and I really echo that of, you know, at least for Black Americans and Black Coloradans, we are locally facing a group of progressives that does not care about us. They use us, and they will parade us out when it's convenient, and then they'll say, hey, go back in there. We don't need you right now. And they do that to the Black lawmakers there too. So one of my things is I'm coming for my people, because that should not happen. You know, if why should we be under attack from both sides? You know, and that's another reason why I targeted Mabry, because he's kind of the example of that. And that's not acceptable. and to target something so so fundamental such as gun rights in that, and to start bullying some of these Black lawmakers that could make the difference. They could be the no votes. But they're not allowed to, and that's there's something wrong with that. And, you know, having that comfort from history to know that, yes, there is a place for this. Yes, there is a responsibility. You know, I'm all in. I'm all in.
You know, I don't know if you've read Charles Cobb's book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. Yep. But again, that had another big impact on me when I read that. And I think it was Fannie Lou Hamer who, I could be wrong about that. But one of the civil rights activists in Mississippi, I think it was, talked about, you know, yes, I'm all in favor of nonviolence, but that does not extend to somebody coming in my house. Somebody comes in my house, they're going to get a shotgun, right? And that's the thing, right? I mean, I believe in nonviolence. I think that, you know, violence as a political tool, it's not a great thing, right? But violence is self-defense. Violence is protecting my family. Violence is protecting my community, the people that I love and respect. Again, don't want it. Don't want it to come down to that. But am I prepared? Is that a legitimate option? Yeah. If violence is going to be inflicted on me or the people I love, then I think I have a right and a duty to inflict violence on those who would try to kill me or the people that I care about.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly where I land as well. You know, I question anybody who wants to proactively take that option away.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, all you have to do is read your history, look at history, and you see where that leads. Kellen, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program. I got to ask one last question. I mean, you said before we got started recording here, you said, I asked, you know, are you with anybody? You said, I'm just a guy. How long has this been an issue for you?
You know, gun rights has been a recent issue.
Okay.
You know, I've grown up, you know, my father taught my brother and I how to shoot starting at 9. And it just never was really an issue. I lived out of state for a little bit. And then I came back to Colorado right when things started getting weird right after 2013. I was like, whoa, this is weird. So that was the first little red flag. I actually went to school with some of those people, too. So I understand on both ends. You know, but then, you know, in the past years, you know, 2023 was the other red flag where I'm like, what is this assault weapons ban? This doesn't seem right. And I started going around to different gun stores and I'm like, hey, this is a thing. How do I contact people? And I didn't know what to do. I was contacting representatives and senators and like nothing. And then 2024, same thing. I'm like, no, I'm going to have to start really getting aggressive with this. And then 2020, here we are again doing the same thing. So it's just been a slow burn.
Well, I'm glad that the spark was lit, Kellen, I got to say. And I really appreciate you coming on the program. I look forward to doing this again. And thank you for being a voice for gun owners out there in Colorado, because we need everybody that we can get. This is an all hands on deck moment. And I'm glad that we've got you out there advocating for our right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah, yep, I'll be here.
All right. Kellen Lanier, thanks so much. And I look forward to doing this again soon, man.
Cool. Thanks.
My thanks to Mr. Lanier for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again in the very near future. And I know that we've talked about these books in the past, but in case you have not heard our discussions about Professor Nicholas Johnson's Negroes in the Gun, The Black Tradition of Arms in America, and Charles Cobb's This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. If you like to read and you like your 2A history, and you have not yet read both of these books, I would strongly encourage you to do so. It is fantastic Second Amendment history. Both of these books talk a lot about some painful chapters in U.S. history. But as I said with Kellen, you know, the right to keep and bear arms, it's a right of we the people. But it is a right that I think has been most beneficial and most useful to the underdogs in our society over the past, you know, 250 years. Those individuals who have been oppressed, who have been targeted, who have been singled out either as a class or as an individual themselves, that's where the right to keep and bear arms really becomes of paramount importance. And our nation's history is replete with stories and incidents and figures who proved the value of our right to keep and bear arms. And both of those books chock full of both history that we all should know, and specifically, again, the importance of our Second Amendment rights. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day in our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Alabama. Now, it was last Thursday, I believe it was, we talked about this incident in Birmingham, Alabama, where a guy who's now accused of murder had gotten out of prison basically less than 24 hours. Well, not prison, jail, basically less than 24 hours earlier. He had been sentenced to, I believe it was 10 years in prison. The majority of that time was stayed in lieu of probation. He was ordered to spend, I think, a year behind bars, but he got credit for time served. Since he had been released on the original charge, he'd been arrested a couple of times for being a felon in possession. At one point, he was arrested for being a felon in possession of a stolen firearm. He was convicted of a violent felony in his past. And yet this judge in Birmingham just kept giving him these, you know, slaps on the wrist, these little love pats. Don't do that again. Don't do that again. And now he's accused of murder. Well, now we've got another story out of Alabama, this time in Montgomery.
The headline, court filings detailed deadly two-day Montgomery crime spree. The suspect, Eric Wendell Scott Jr., was out of prison on probation at the time. Now, he had not been out for 24 hours, but it's still bad enough. 28-year-old Eric Wendell Scott, facing one count now of capital murder, two counts of attempted murder, shooting into an occupied vehicle, first-degree robbery, all of which happened, again, during a two-day span last week, starting around 12:15 last Wednesday, when Scott is accused of pulling out a handgun, walking up to a woman who was sitting in her car, shooting her nine times, hitting her in the chest. She was taken to a local hospital in critical condition. Less than 12 hours after that, he's accused of shooting 31-year-old Michael Ligon to death. Both Scott and Ligon were inside Ligon's vehicle when Ligon was shot. He then pulled the victim's body out of the car, allegedly, and drove off in an unknown location. 12:15 on Thursday, so a little bit more than 24 hours after Ligon was killed, Scott's accused of pulling a gun on a 16-year-old, demanding the teen's property, then shooting him in the leg. He is then accused of following the teen to the middle of a parking lot where he stole the victim's car keys from his pants pocket and then shot him in the face. Yeah, and then allegedly stole the victim's van. Thankfully, despite being shot in the leg and the face, the Montgomery Police Department said the injuries that the teen suffered were not life-threatening. Scott was taken into custody on Friday at some point. And according to the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office, Scott was previously convicted of attempted murder in a 2016 case. WSFA in Alabama reports that that verdict was overturned by the Court of Criminal Appeals. Scott's case was sent back to a lower court for a do-over, and that time around, Scott pleaded guilty. He was ordered in May of 2022 to serve a 20-year split sentence. 5 years to serve, 2 years on probation. And again, one of the conditions is if he violated the terms of his probation, then he would be sent back to prison to serve the entirety of his sentence. Okay, well, if he's convicted of these most recent charges, I'm saying he's going back to prison either way, considering he's accused of murder and attempted murder. Yeah, going back to prison for attempted murder. Probably not going to add any more time to what he is currently facing. But again, we go back to this. May of 2022, he was told, you got to go to prison for 5 years. Okay. Well, it's not even May 2025 yet. So we're less than 3 years after that five-year sentence was imposed. And yet, Mr. Scott is already back out on the street. So again, what's going on here? And to all of these Democrat lawmakers in Alabama who say, well, we need more gun control, that's probably permitless carry and blah, blah, blah. No. Look at the criminal justice system. Look at what is happening. The individuals who are convicted of violent, serious violent offenses, who are getting a kiss on the cheek from Lady Justice and sent on their merry way. You remember last Thursday, the individual who was accused of this shooting, murder of a 21-year-old man less than 24 hours after he was released from custody. He had originally, when he was told, you've done your time, right? Time served. He was placed on supervised probation. And then the judge removed that supervised probation, put him on unsupervised probation, which continued even after he was arrested for being a felon in possession of a stolen firearm. So, no, Alabama doesn't need more gun laws. But I will say there at the very least, needs to be a serious investigation into what is going on in the criminal justice system. And if there is a need for reform, maybe truth in sentencing laws, maybe reducing or taking away judges' discretion to deviate from these recommended sentences and instead, offer probation to serious violent offenders, then let's start there. Because we've given two examples over the past two shows of deadly consequences for these judicial decisions. All right. On to today's armed citizen story. From Lansing, Michigan, where police say there will be no charges in a fatal shooting that happened in Lansing last December. Honestly, I'm not sure why it took until March to make this official. It was December 29th, around 10:30 in the evening. Lansing police called to a reported shooting. Two people found in an apartment with gunshot wounds. One of the victims, identified as DeAndre Lucky, found outside of the apartment complex with several gunshot wounds. He was taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. The other victim found inside the apartment was treated at the hospital and did survive. And as it turns out, the victim who was found inside the apartment was truly the victim. DeAndre Lucky was the aggressor, according to law enforcement. They say that Lucky attacked the victim in an attempted robbery. Lucky shot the man in the chest, and the man was ultimately able to produce a firearm of his own, returning fire, all of which police say was caught on video surveillance outside of the apartment. So again, if you've got this video evidence, you've been able to talk to the victim who was shot here, who could corroborate that story. But again, you can see for yourself what happened. Then why did it take 2.5 months to determine that no charges were applicable here? The Ingham County Prosecutor's Office said it reviewed the case thoroughly, determined that the facts and evidence support a claim of lawful self-defense. And since the shooting and ultimate death of Mr. Lucky was justified, there will be no criminal charges pursued against the other individual whose name has not been released because, again, he was the victim of a crime. And finally today, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a woman in Baytown, Texas, by the name of Robin Gold, who came to the aid of a stranger on the pickleball court and saved a man's life thanks to her knowledge of CPR. She spoke with Channel 13 Eyewitness News, KTRK in Houston. She says that she's a pickleball fanatic. And she says she's gotten to know many people who love the sport as much as she does. So she said she was playing a game. Actually, she just finished. She was sitting down with a friend, and they were talking. When she said, out of the corner of my eye, I saw this gentleman fall off the stage and land on his face. Now, Gold, who's now retired, worked at the Exxon Mobil refinery in Baytown, Texas, and she was trained as a first responder there. So she did know CPR thanks to her previous employer. She says the first time, though, she's ever had to put those skills to use outside of the refinery. But she ran over, rolled a man over, wasn't breathing, had no pulse. She told someone to call 911, told someone else to get the defibrillator there, and she started performing CPR. She said she did chest compressions for about 7 minutes. Shocked him with the defibrillator once, and then she says they started to see signs of life. She said, I rolled him back over. When I went to do the next compression, he hollered. It hurt him, and he kind of came to, and I was like, yes! Paramedics arrived soon after, loaded the man up, took him to the hospital. Gold says she was able to see him later that night. She said, I met his wife, his daughter, also his brother. Of course, there were lots of tears and hugging and thanking. She said, I got a big hug from him, and he looked so good. He didn't look like he should be in a hospital bed. Seriously, she said, he looked so good. Well, I give all the credit in the world to Robin Gold for that. She was asked by KTRK if her actions made her a hero. She said, no, not in her eyes. But she does hope that what she did inspires others. She said most people who perform CPR will do so on a friend or a loved one. She says everybody should brush up on their Red Cross CPR standards. Know where the defibrillators are in areas where you spend a lot of time. She said, I was fortunate that I was in the right place at the right time and had the skills to help him. Well, I would say not as fortunate as the man who she helped, but yes, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for someone in need. Robin Gold there in Baytown, Texas, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that has got to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We'll be covering the latest Second Amendment news and information. But of course, we're doing that at BearingArms.com too. So you don't have to wait until tomorrow's Cam & Company. Just be sure to check out the website. We're keeping you up to date all day long, including a very surprising take from the Washington Post editorial board on Mexico's lawsuit against U.S. gun makers. I think we are starting to see signs that Jeff Bezos' edict that the paper's editors are going to start promoting personal liberties and free markets I think that is actually coming to pass. So, well, we've got that story and much more for you at BearingArms.com. Have a great rest of your Monday, as good as Mondays can be. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.